Welcome to the fifth episode of the Record Business Podcast, hosted by Sam Freeman. I've been interviewing people in the music business since 2012, both on the audio and business side of things. My audio podcast is called Speak Hertz, where I talk to producers, artists, gear companies, etc. And the record business is where I talk to music executives at labels, publishers, institutions, etc. My guest today is Henrik Frisk, the vice principal at the Royal School of Music in Stockholm. I had visited the school some months back and wanted to learn more about their programs, so Henrik was kind enough to sit down with me and talk about the school's history, their students, what they have going on, and a bunch of other things. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Hi there, Henrik.
Hi, Sam.
Thank you for coming down from KMH to talk to me.
Well, that's really my pleasure. It's exciting to be here, I have to say, for many reasons.
No, it's a pleasure to have you. Yeah, we had met at KMH, which is a Kungliga Musikhögskolan, and you gave me a tour of the place.
Yeah.
And after seeing how extensive the facilities were, I thought it'd be nice to chat. But prior to you getting involved in KMH, you had your music education in the 90s. I guess, at Rytmisk Musikkonservatorium in Denmark?
That's right. I went there for 2 years, studied saxophone. I'm a tenor saxophonist, jazz major, and that's what I did for the first 15 years of my career, I'd say. I worked a lot with contemporary big bands. I wrote a lot of big band music and toured. I had my own big band toured with and small groups and stuff. But yeah, Copenhagen in the 90s, that was a lot of fun.
What was the program?
It was like saxophone major, it was like musician major instrument. So specifically, it was one of the few at that time, I'd say the only school that had specialized entirely on jazz and improvised musics. So it was a tiny little school. We're actually in an apartment building in Frederiksberg in the middle of Copenhagen. It's like 5 or 6 stories high, and it's like a couple of rooms in each store, and only about, say, 25, 30 students altogether.
But then you also did like a year at the Banff Center for Arts in Canada?
Yeah, so the thing was that before starting my studies in Copenhagen, I went to New York because I had a year over, so to speak. I was accepted at the conservatory, but I couldn't start at that semester when I was accepted because I had to do my military service. That ended in October, so I basically had almost a full year. So I went to New York and took some private lessons there with a pianist called Richie Byrack and a saxophonist, Dave Liebman. And I was extremely inspired by, of course, by the environment there. And so then I came back to start my studies in Copenhagen. But then the first summer, I went away again. I went to New York for that summer. And at that time, I met some musicians that had been at the Banff Center. So what happened was that, I don't recommend this, but after the second year in conservatory, I dropped out. I went back to, because I'd gotten a scholarship then to go to the Banff Center, another amazing place located in the middle of the Rocky Mountains, not so far from Calgary. And it was this sort of interdisciplinary art center there where you could study. And I spent, I think, 9 months or something there. Just there was nothing but all the artists, and there were dancers and visual artists and musicians, and we did concerts and we hung out, and there was us and the Elks basically, and a couple of bears.
But then you also did some time at the Malmö Academy of Music at Lund.
Exactly. So then after that, and then I thought I'd go back to New York, but then I got really fed up with New York and Lower East Side, and I went back to Sweden. And rather than moving back to Copenhagen, I decided to live in Malmö because I had some relatives in southern Sweden, and it was close enough that I could keep doing my gigs in Denmark, but live in Malmö. But then I got really interested, or I got more and more interested in composition. So I took a program, which is really only 1 year program in composition. I studied classical composition with the professor there was Hans G. Fosch. He's a renowned opera composer here in Sweden.
Okay. And then I guess from the mid to late 90s and onwards, you had a career in jazz.
Yeah, exactly. But then in the like late 90s, I started getting more and more interested in electronics. And partly, this was actually going back to the Banff Center. That's where I met this Canadian, or he's an American composer, but he lived in Canada at that time, Jim Tenney. I mean, he had a huge influence on me. He was a good friend of Cage, Don Cage. And he had his ideas about microtonality that inspired me a lot, but I didn't understand any of it. That was the reason I started, you know, fiddling around with synthesizers, because I wanted to, you know, work with just intonation. And that was an easy way to do it, and because you can tune synths exactly to the frequencies that you want to. But then I sort of departed from just intonation and just started playing around with electronics in that way. And one of the things that I did then for many years was I would do solo concerts, saxophone, and live electronics. I would have the computer process my playing in real time and trying to figure out musically in challenging ways to deal with that, sort of duo with electronics.
And on the teaching side, it seems like that would have started for you around 97 at the Rhythmic Conservatory. You had some kind of a position there up until 2001?
Yes, a little bit. I taught theory and I was conducting the big band at the Rhythmic Conservatory. And then I think 2000 or 2001, I was hired by Musikhögskolan in Malmö. So there I was in charge of the jazz program there for some years.
So how did you get your foot into KMH? Was it through the associate professor position in 2011?
Yes, exactly. So then at that time I had finished my PhD. So I had a PhD in music, and I actually had done, so I had this, which is in Sweden called a docent, which is the next level of scholarship. And at that time, KMH was at the point where it wanted to develop its artistic research, its research in music. So I was hired to do that, to supervise a couple of PhDs that they had hired and to develop their research environment. So I worked with that, and that's pretty much what I have continued working on since then.
So then I guess you were an associate professor for a while, and then on a part-time level, and then you became a full-time guy in 2019?
Yeah, exactly. So by 2019, I worked like maximum 50% at KMH and then freelance the rest of the time. But then at 2019, luckily, the year or two before the pandemic, I got the opportunity to step up. And that worked well with my personal life at that time, when the kids were at the age when it was like, well, good to just have a gig like that, the steady gig. And I imagined myself maybe then stepping down to 50% again, but then came the pandemic and then everything has changed.
Indeed. So now you became professor of music officially.
Yes, that's right. In 2019 or something like that. Yeah.
Okay. And your teaching department was electroacoustic music composition?
Exactly. So in the beginning, I worked only with research and tutoring PhD candidates. But then eventually, I started getting more and more involved with the electroacoustic music department. When we met up there, I think you rightly asked, what's the difference between electroacoustic music and electronic music? And it's an odd distinction. And I can't say that I'm a huge fan of it. It's more of a genre description than it is any. So we usually think electronic music would generally be anything that involves electronic sounds. Whereas electroacoustic music is something more, you know, it's sort of defined as a genre, as something like, you know, music that you produce in a studio and you play back on speakers rather than with musicians.
Oh, so bedroom production.
Yeah, you call it that. You know, before digital recorders, it used to be called tape music, because you recorded onto tape by cutting and splicing tapes and putting them together, and then you just played back the tape on two speakers and the audience would listen to the speakers. It's very, very odd for someone who has never been to a concert like that to like understand why do we all sit in a concert hall listening to only speakers. But there's a place for it. It's interesting. Yeah. But yeah, so that department then is for composition, electronic music composition, really. So the composition department, KMH, is divided up in classical composition, electronic music composition, and then jazz composition. But we work really closely together. So basically, it's a group of 40, 50 students. Our students tend to be a little bit more radical in their aesthetic expressions than maybe the classical are more like... Well, they work with orchestra music. And I shouldn't forget, we have a film music department too.
And you've also, it seems in recent times, scaled the ladder from professor of music to vice principal of some sort?
Yeah. But this is very temporary. So what happens is that our rector stepped down.
The principal.
So the principal. So the vice principal had to step up, and then they needed a new vice principal. So I did that. So that's only until the summer, basically. But I did that because I'm vice principal with my responsibility is research. And as I said, for 10 years, I've been working with this, but it, you know, it's been sort of going back and forth depending on what the principal has wanted or the leadership has wanted KMH to move in. But I felt that I worked up all these ideas that I would like to do with research at KMH. And this, to stepping up to take this role, I have the mandate to do things that I think are good for the school. And so that's, you know, that was one of the reasons that I accepted that.
So from what I understand with KMH, it's the oldest highest institution of music education in Sweden?
It's not the highest. There are a number of institutions that teach music at the same level. But KMH is the only one that's independent. So we're not part of any other university. So the whole KMH is one university college, and there's nothing else but music. Whereas if you look at Musikhögskolan in Gothenburg, for example, they're part of Gothenburg University. They're just a department in Gothenburg University. So this gives us a bit of freedom that maybe the other schools don't really have. And also we're the oldest. We've been here since 1971.
I see. So it used to be that you were attached to the Royal Swedish Academy of Music, I guess. And then as of the 70s, that's no longer the case.
Yes, sort of. It was the Academy of Music. And the Swedish radio actually had an orchestra school. And those two, I might be wrong about this, but it, you know, along the lines of those two merging and then creating in the 70s, KMH.
So now it's essentially state-owned.
Yep.
And it reports to the Ministry of Education, I think.
Yeah, exactly.
And so being state-owned, what does that mean for the type of programs that you offer and the kind of resources that are available to you?
Well, it means that we get allocated a number of student positions. Currently, I think we have about 1,300 students. So a number of those are music teacher students. So we get a number of student positions, and there's a sum of money associated with each of those students. So that's our funding, basically. The number of students we have define the funding that we have. Then we have a little bit of funding outside of that, but it's very little. So it's really geared towards the number of students that we have and the fact that our students graduate. So if we have student aid don't graduate, we get only a third or two-thirds of that funding for that student. So that our incitement to offer good education and make them really go through. And this is similar. I mean, in that respect, where there's no difference between us and Stockholm University, for example. But then we have a couple of special programs, and electroacoustic music composition is one of those. We have a special assignment for the government to have education in this style, if you wish. And we also have choir conducting. And the reason behind, I mean, the logic behind that is that choirs is like a really big thing in Sweden, and we've been really successful. I'd say a lot of our conductors have made great success in the world. And electronic music or electroacoustic music is one of the few styles in Sweden, apart from popular music, that have like really put Sweden on the map. In the 60s, people traveled from New York to Stockholm to hear the newest music, and So this is really exciting. And Lars-Gunnar Bodin, who was one, there was this particular style that they developed, and Lars-Gunnar Bodin was one of them. It's called text sound composition. It was like a precursor to spoken word. So you would write a poem, you would record it, and then you would cut and splice the tape in various ways so that you heard other sounds from what was originally words. So you get these musical qualities out of a poetry reading. It's just just truly fascinating. And that was like completely unique at that time. Like John Cage, as we were talking about before, him and John Tudor came to Stockholm to do concerts here because it was like the hippest place at that time. And Lars-Gunnar Bodin was also the one who founded the electronic music studio at KMH. So he was the first professor in electronic music composition at KMH. There's a lineage there that goes through. So that's the reason we have the special assignment with a little bit of extra money from the government to equip, like you saw, the studios that we have, which are like, and to maintain them, and because it costs money, as you know.
Of course. But do students pay tuition there?
No, it's like any other Swedish university. Education is free of charge.
Do you know how many new students get enrolled each year on average?
No, but I gather this is a bit of guesswork for me, but I'd say around 300-400 maybe.
What are the general requirements for getting accepted?
Now, so that's really different between different programs. What we test when we do the entrance tests is really artistic proficiency. Like, can you express yourself on your instrument? Or have you written enough music so that you can shape a musical ID in notation or in, you know, electronic music, whatever program you apply for? Our program in electroacoustic music, for example, is we've more or less taken away the theory test because we don't work with classical music theory in that program. So it doesn't make sense to test something which isn't actually part of the program. Whereas if you apply for another program, music theory might actually be, you know, the requirements might be quite high. So it's really different between programs.
Interesting. What kind of international footprint does KMH have as far as foreign students, exchange students, maybe institutions in other countries or partnerships with institutions outside of Sweden?
We have a lot of partners. We have too many partners is our problem right now. So the work we're doing now is to downsize a little bit and focus more on a few partners that we can then spend more energy and time with. We have a lot of students that want to take an exchange semester at KMH, for example. Many more than we can accept. I think we accept just a few of those that apply. I think we had 11 for composition this year, and we could take one. So that's, you know, there's an interest. There's an international interest. It's really difficult for some reason. And I just learned that this is the same for all programs in Sweden, all universities, that Swedish students are not very willing to go abroad. And no one really seems to know why that is.
I thought it was the opposite.
Yeah, no, apparently not. Like, it's really difficult. So we have more students coming in than we have going out, which is a shame because if we had more students going out, we could accept more students coming in because it's, you know, it's an exchange, right? We have a strong collaboration with Sibelius in Helsinki, for example, but also Copenhagen and Berlin, De Montfort University in the UK. The UK is, after Brexit, it was a mess. So it's really, unfortunately, really difficult for us to work with them. But we also have a lot of students applying to our programs, international students. And some years we've had only international students in the master's program for composition, for example. We've been lucky with having really good students in the electroacoustic music program. So some of those students have become quite successful after graduation. And that's really the best, ad you can have, because they go out playing and then people come up to them after and ask them, what did you study? And then, like, we can see there's a whole trail of international students coming to us because they've heard so-and-so play at that stage. So
very interesting. In terms of the actual facilities, what do they tend to look like as far as the amount of buildings that you have, the studio spaces, the live rooms, etc.?
Yeah, so we have three concert halls, out of which one is explicitly made for electronic music and electronically amplified music. So that's the hall where I tend to work most. And we also in that hall have like a dome of 29 speakers in a configuration so that we can sort of like Dolby Atmos or spatializing sounds and experiment with spatialization. And then we have, I think there's about 7 or 8 studios of various degrees, some of which are more production studios where you just, like, there's no real recording room associated to them, but then there's a couple where with larger spaces. But we have this really nice digital infrastructure for audio, so that it's quite easy to just use any room as a playing room. And then you can just connect that to any studio if you want to record. So that works really well. The way it is structured now is that we have divided up so that, if, especially for the studio complex, there's an audio, audio and media division, those that record the concerts, I mean our staff, they have a couple of studios where they work. And then there's a media, music and media program. They have two studios, I think, that only their students work in. And then we have three studios for only our students. One could imagine that there was a more flow of people going in and out of these spaces. But this is for traditional reasons. It's been divided up like that. And now we do that, at least for the time being.
And speaking of tradition, when it comes to how the student body is divided between the different departments, is it accurate to say that, at least historically, the classical division has had the largest enrollment?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I mean, the classical department is, I think, 1/3 of the school. So it's very large. There's tradition in that building, definitely.
And given the last, let's say, 15 years of development, so let's say, having seen the bedroom producer phenomena be unleashed and music making maybe becoming more automation-based, let's say, because of DAWs and samples and loops, and less so about playing skill. How has KMH adjusted to the possibility that more students will be less interested in a classical music training as opposed to a modern or contemporary one?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question and an interesting one. I think that KMH has adapted to that, has adapted to it very well, but only in the programs that we've been talking about here mostly. So like the composition program and the music and media program, the jazz programs primarily, they've adapted to the changing scene to a large extent. They're quite different now than they were just 15 years ago. If we look at our student population at Electroacoustic Music Department, it's just completely different. It's a completely different nature than it was 10 years ago only. So this has been quite a quick change. Now, the problem for the classical music department is really, it's tricky, right? Because if you want to teach students to play symphony orchestra, for example, you need to have a symphony orchestra. But if you want to have a symphony orchestra, you need all the instruments of the orchestra. And if you don't have people that want to apply to the oboe program or the bassoon program, you don't have oboes and bassoons, and then you can't have the symphony orchestra, and then you can't train the flutists, of which you have 10. So this is, you know, this is really tricky, and this is a big discussion that goes way beyond, I think, just the responsibility of KMH, and it has to do with what kind of music, what kind of cultural scene do we want, and what is it we want from kids. I mean, just today, the government took away the choice for what's it called, the second subject choice, so now you can't choose music in the gymnasium. And this is, I think this is quite sad, because there used to be all these little things. There used to be all these options. I think it's great that we can accept, which we can now. I mean, anyone who has a computer and spends time with it and makes music will eventually be able to apply to a program at KMH. I mean, it will be tough, but it's tough for everyone, right? That's possible. But we also want it to be possible for that kid who wants to choose to play the oboe to do that. And we're actually taking away that. And the question is not like, what is it we take away? The question is, what are we left with? Whatever I might think about, you know, the classical tradition, or as that's beyond the point, is like, I'm interested in that diversity is actually possible. And in that diverse future, I want to see oboe too.
No, of course. It is a challenge making things like that more appealing, because pop culture is a part of the reason why, you know, the shift is taking place the way that it is.
Exactly. And it's so massive, and it's like really difficult to escape. But then, of course, this discussion is much, much bigger than this, and it has many more angles to it. But I'm not so worried about KMH. I think we'll be able to stay on top of things for the foreseeable future. The biggest risk, I think, is the cutting of funding for music education altogether. because we've been seeing that cut going on for a long, long time. For the last 30 years, they've cut our funding a little bit every year. And eventually, you know, you come to a point where, you know, it's not possible anymore. Like, we can't do this any longer, you know. So that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about the broader sort of cut down on music education, but also on culture. And yeah.
What is the competitive advantage that you think students who attend KMH might have over, say, going to another Scandinavian music institution? Is it the resources that you provide on campus? Is it the ability to produce a consistent quality of musician? Is it always just the prestige of having gone to KMH that helps them in the job market? What do you think is the biggest advantage?
I don't think it's the prestige, because I don't really think... I mean, in my field, there's no one who asks for, where did you study? Like, it's not a factor. I think network, I mean, the ability to spend time here in Stockholm and then network with all the other students and all the faculty, that, I mean, to get access to that, I think is probably the biggest advantage. I do think that, you know, the facilities that we have and that we offer that, but I think that to a lesser degree than the fact that you're in an environment where there's music being made in many different genres, like not 24/7, but almost.
Off the top of your head, do you know who some of your more famous alumni is, particularly in the last decade or two?
Yes. Well, I would say Colin Malone is maybe the most, the one now who attracts the most attention. She was a student of mine, actually, in the master's program. And so she's an electroacoustic composer. But she does these live performances. She makes pieces for... she actually works a lot with Just Intonation. She makes these, like, dream-like pieces. So a little bit on the drone-y side, but, yeah.
I think it's traditionally thought that people in the past who graduated from KMH would go on to have some classical music kind of career, playing violin for London Philharmonic or something like that. Perhaps in more recent times, you're a jazz musician who's always on the road touring with different bands. In your experience, what are some of the more typical career trajectories that you do see from people that graduate KMH? Is it still that, or has it become other things?
Right. Well, this is an extraordinarily good question. It's still that, but it's also a lot of other things. So we have this particular program called Edsberg, which is a different campus where they have a chamber music program with insane success rate. Like there's a classical music competition right now, and out of five, three of the finalists are current students there, and it's like they're really hitting it, as you know, a combination of really good teachers and a really good environment that makes for that. We're just starting a new program, which is really different from the other programs that we have at KMH currently. It's called the AIM, Artistic Interdisciplinary Masters in Music. So it's a master program focused on interdisciplinarity, both between artistic disciplines, but also between music. We've been working on that for quite some time. So preparing for that, we did a lot of alumni studies just to exactly figure that out. What happens to our students? Where do they go? Because traditionally, we've been really bad at alumni work. We don't really know what happens. We don't keep track of our students, which is silly. I mean, if you look at an American university, that's what they do. Like, they track them for every step they take. So what you see is that most of them do work, but not all of them work in the field that they got their education from. But most of them do work within the broader field of music. So this I find extremely inspiring. The fact that you can maybe study the violin for 3 or 5 years and then go out and then work with music, but maybe not necessarily playing the violin, but you use all the competences that you learned during those 5 years in related fields. So I don't understand why there should be a one-to-one mapping between what you're taught and what you actually then, what kind of job you get. So the main reason I find this inspiring is that I think that we are quite good at teaching our students to be creative, and that kind of creativity is very, very useful. So here are a couple of more examples that we saw that our students in the electroacoustic music programs, they get hired as programmers for game music companies and things like that. Now that's odd because we don't teach them. We don't have one class of program of like classical programming. That's not in our curriculum. We have a little bit of music programming, but that's very specific to the field of music. So the only explanation I can see in that is that, well, the actual skill of programming, you can learn that. You can look it up on YouTube if you want to. But the creativity and the ability to address complex problems quickly is something that you learn in musical practices. So that, you know, if that's an answer to your question, but I'm happy if our students go out and fill the whole world. I think a world filled with musicians would be a better place generally.
No, I agree. With the year ending, what are your hopes for 2024 in KMH and some developments that you'd like to see unfold at the school?
Yeah, well, so I'm really hoping that some of the work that I do now with developing the research field at KMH will play out, and I'm really anxious to see that happening. I also see that, somebody mentioned we have this collaboration with Sibelius. We have a couple of workshops that we're doing in the spring in the field of spatialization, experimental spatialization in sound and music that I'm also really eager to see play out. Then I really hope that we get a new principal, and then maybe I can get more time to do music after the summer. I'm in a really creative phase right now, so I have a lot of ideas for compositions that I'm just waiting. Actually, I'm happy now to confront the holidays with composing.
How nice. Oh, so you don't want to stay vice principal?
I don't know. I mean, that would completely depend on who's the principal, right? I don't think I would mind, but it's important for me to also have time to stay with the creative side, because otherwise I'm not happy.
So if they want to promote you to principal, you turn that down?
No, that's a tricky question, but I don't think they would do that, but I would think about it hard. It would depend on the reasons that they promote me. If it's just because they can't find anyone else. No, but you know, that's a full-time commitment, right? There's not much space for other things. And right now, where I'm at, I'm interested in working more, to continue working creatively.
Well, thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
Thank you, Sam. It was a pleasure.